Hey, what's going on, y'all? This is just Stone Kingfish Ingram from Iron City Rocks.
Hey, this is Eric Johnson, and you are listening to Iron City Rocks.
Hey, everybody, this is Kenny Lane Shepherd, and you're listening to Iron City Rocks.
Hello and welcome to episode 549 of the Iron City Rocks podcast. I'm your host John, coming to you from the Iron City of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, bringing you the best rock, hard rock, heavy metal, and blues talk on the net. Episode 549, we are joined by Mr. John McDermott, which is a name that may ring a bell with some of you if you were an aficionado of Jimi Hendrix. He is the catalog director for Experience Hendrix. He has authored several books on Jimi Hendrix and produced several films on Jimi Hendrix, and he's also the mastermind behind the upcoming Experience Hendrix tour, which will be coming into Greensburg, Pennsylvania, to do a show on March 13th at the Palace Theater. That show's lineup includes Kenny Wayne Shepherd, Chris Stone, Kingfish Ingram, Eric Johnson, Dweezil Zappa, Devin Allman, Noah Hunt, and the list goes on from there. Chris Layton, not to name drop, but the drummer for Stevie Ray Vaughan, also on that bill. So an amazing lineup of music, paying tribute to one of the absolute all-time greats. Experience Hendrix Tour has been coming around for, I'd say, the better part of a decade at least. I think most of you have caught a lineup here or there, or at least we're aware of it. This one, an amazing lineup as always. So we got a chance to talk to John about how this comes together. How do you get all these artists to come out and do, a song or two or three or a jam session? How do you entice these artists into coming out to do this? Is there kind of a waiting list? How do you juggle the schedules? And just a little bit about that. So we're going to get into that interview now with Mr. John McDermott.
The morning is dead. And the day is through. There's nothing left here to leave but the velvet moon. All my loneliness I have felt today. It's a little more than enough to make a man throw himself away. And I continue to burn the midnight now. Still hanging on my frowning wall.
really doesn't bother me too much at all. It's just the ever-falling dust that makes it so hard for me to see. That forgotten earring laying on the floor, facing coldly toward the door. And I continue to burn the midnight lamp.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, my pleasure to welcome to Iron City Rocks. We have on the line John McDermott. How are you doing today, John?
Very well. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. For those not intimately familiar with the Experience Hendrix tour and the kind of the Jimi Hendrix or Experience Hendrix brand, can you explain for the listeners kind of what your role is and how you fit into that empire?
Well, I had obviously a fan of Jimmy's music, had done a lot of projects in the music industry. But Eddie Kramer and I wrote a book called Hendrix Setting the Record Straight, which was published in 1992. We followed that up with a tribute album called Stone Free, a tribute to Jimi Hendrix, which came out in 93. It had Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck and Buddy Guy, Pearl Jam and Soundgarden, a lot of wonderful artists that took part. Sure. And the goal of that record, and it still does it today, is it generates scholarships in Jimmy's name at the United Negro College Fund. So when we finished that project, it was very successful. Eddie and I felt we had done Jimmy well, and we moved back to our own respective projects. But it was during that period that I got word that the Hendrix family was involved in a very contentious litigation. Their former lawyer was trying to sell their legacy out from under them to MCA Records.
Okay.
So I volunteered during that time to help them. And, after a lot of work and dedicated effort by our great team of attorneys, we were able to reclaim all of the rights that Jimmy's father, the late Al Hendrix, controlled, which is, master recordings and publishing, really everything involved with the legacy. Jimmy was unique in that manner. So they asked me to stay on board with them and manage the music catalog going forward. So since 1995, I've been involved with Janie Hendrix and Eddie Kramer in creating the album releases and the documentaries and all things to do with Jimmy's music catalog.
Which, sounds like a kind of an interesting thing, but I imagine there's quite a bit, with licensing and things like that, do you deal with that directly? Like if, product A wants to use, Little Wing in a commercial, would they come to you then to negotiate the terms of that? Or how does that work?
I mean, there are a lot of steps, but ultimately those decisions on that level are really made by Experience Hendrix and Janie Hendrix. Okay. So, for us, what we tend to do is we will, we identify a series of releases that we want to come out because we want to, look at further exploring, for example, Jimmy's work with the Band of Gypsies. So there's this or, like we most recently did with Electric Lady Studios, like putting together a film, a box set, and coordinating all of that with Sony. So I'm very fortunate in that manner in which we're able to kind of look at the entirety of Jimmy's career, look at the materials that we have available to us to try to help, provide context, articulate what Jimmy was trying to do. So that's my primary focus, is really hoping to provide a deeper appreciation and understanding for the many, really fascinating elements of this guy's life and career.
Were you involved then, like as these were reissued, as vinyl kind of exploded in the last, call it 5-6 years, were you involved in determining what was released and variants and things like that, like record store date type stuff as well? Or
all of that? Yeah, I'm directly involved with all of that. And vinyl for Jimi Hendrix fans, it's a really important component of what we do. So, we started a relationship back in 2011 with QRP Record Manufacturing in Salina, Kansas. And they're, in our view, they're like the leading, from a quality perspective, manufacturer that's out there in the world. So we take it very seriously. We use Bernie Grundman, who's a wonderful mastering engineer, legendary guy, to make sure that, every step of the way, we're effectively taking what, Jimi Hendrix and Eddie Kramer put on that tape in 1970 and bringing it forward to, 2025 in as best quality as we can.
Is in your role, I remember very distinctly being at like an off-price store sometime in the probably the 90s was, I think, when I really started to get into Jimmy's music, and finding like CDs of things that were not really official releases. They weren't necessarily, I don't know, they were bootlegs because they were sold in pretty mass market stores, but they were kind of off-branded, not, you know, through the label kind of stuff. Do you guys kind of, is that a big deal anymore? Like, piracy or
well,
kind of
certainly
unofficial releases.
I think Jimmy was plagued when he became famous. Mm-hmm. You know, prior to that, he had been, you know, kind of an itinerant sideman, occasional guy who would be hired to play on various studio sessions. Mm-hmm. And you know, he signed one contract when he was providing guitar work for Curtis Knight in 1965, which really hamstrung him. You know, once he became famous, the guy that he had signed this contract, Jimmy thought it was just a simple release for the work that he had done. You know, he had signed him, which bound him for 3 years. So the guy popped up out of the woodwork after Jimmy Chas Chandler had taken him to England and he became famous. This guy popped up and said, no, I have this artist. So, you know, ultimately, that's where you saw all of those releases where you'd have a big picture of Jimmy on the front cover and the music inside would be Curtis Knight. So, yeah. You know, you had a lot of these instances where early sessions that he did would be marketed as if they were the, you know, the sequel to Electric Ladyland. And yeah. That confused a lot of fans. Me, of course, being one of them. Mm-hmm. Happened in the vinyl era and it happened in the CD era. We've been lucky that we were able to resolve that situation. We defeated that person that had brought this, got all of the tapes that he had originally had, and presented them to fans in a meaningful way so they could understand. It is okay to be able to say, like, look, this is what Jimi Hendrix did in 1965 with right. Curtis Knight. You know, and the same thing with Little Richard. I mean, there were all these albums featuring these recordings as if Jimmy was on them. He did a single with Little Richard. He played with him live, but he did a single. And now we have that available on West Coast Seattle Boy. So, you know, his work with the Isley Brothers, all that stuff is fascinating, but it has to be presented in the right context so that fans don't feel ripped off.
Yeah. And I do remember it being kind of confusing. And this is obviously way before the internet. So you didn't have things like Discog and places like that, that you could get information on releases. You just saw it and I'll pick this up. And then you get it home and you're like, what is this? You know, so it was always good to find, you know, the real releases. And you know, as you guys have continued to release things through the years, I think it's made somebody who was relevant, but it gives us something to look forward to too, which is a wonderful thing. And you know, you're going to get a quality product.
We appreciate that. I mean, Jimmy created a lot of amazing music, but what you said is exactly really what we try to do, which is, you know, bring interesting things, which, you know, broaden your understanding or appreciation of Jimmy, you know, so whether it's a live album or the documentary, any of these various things, you know, effectively we're kind of looking and saying, look, here's, this colors in this chapter of his life and career. And I think having the ability to do that, that's one of the real benefits of working for Experience Hendrix, and that, you know, you don't have to go to the label to get them to sign off and then another guy. You know, we're really able to kind of go forward and say, this year, this is our project. We want to focus attention on this.
Yeah. And in a situation where you're really looking at the best interest of the legacy of the artist, as opposed to just capitalizing on it, you know, that's a, you know, very evident when you look at, you know, other artists of that era, that, you know, the seventh live album from a single tour keeps getting churned out almost on clockwork. I don't want to mention artist names, but there are certain artists that you know, you could tell it's just, okay, this is how we're going to make revenue in 2025. We have these two releases and we'll have two more next year. And they lack, you know, the substance, I think. Can you talk a little bit about, for those who may not have seen the Experience Hendrix tour, kind of what somebody walking into that event, obviously you see a list of names, you know, people, you know, I know every time we post about one of these coming, you know, people kind of, hey, I wish this person was in, or that's going to be so cool to see this person. But how does that take shape for those who aren't familiar?
This was an idea that I had more than 20 years ago, which was, you know, you remember I did the Stone Free album. That was an idea that I had that I brought to Eddie Kramer and Felix Carcano, so a friend of ours who worked with us on that project. And this is a similar thing, which is, you know, it's really about the songs. That's the connectivity between generations, between fans, no matter where they are in the world. So the idea of this tour was, you know, we effectively, when we started, looked at a Roots to the Fruits idea, which was, you know, let's get some of the artists who, like Buddy Guy and Hubert Sumlin, who were influences on Jimmy. Let's get some of Jimmy's contemporaries. So over the years, we've had Santana, Paul Rodgers. You know, we had Jimmy's original musicians like Mitch Mitchell before he passed. We had Billy Cox, who recently retired. So, you know, we've tried to look then at those whose music he's influenced, but yet in a different way, so that, you know, you may have the precision of an Eric Johnson with the, you know, the loud attack of a Zakk Wylde, the deep blues of a Christone Kingfish Ingram. You've got Devin Allman. You got everybody comes at it with a different perspective. And I think it's the collaborative presentation of that that makes it special. We don't do this every year. We have not done this tour since 2019. You know, so it isn't like Beatlemania. We're not looking to like replicate what Jimmy wore or the exact tones. If you love his music, and one of the things that we have seen over the years is that, you know, it could be Stevie Ray Vaughan covering it. It could be John Mayer covering it. It could be anybody covering his music. It just brings an awareness of him that's fresh. And I think that's the spirit of what we do on this tour. So if you're coming to see the show, you're going to see, it's not a freewheeling jam session. You're going to see 20 to 25 songs, classic Jimi Hendrix songs, performed collaboratively by all of these artists. So it's a fun night. It's a special night. You know, in an era now where even the encores are kind of expected and known, we look to avoid that. We bring special guests in, you know, unannounced guests, all of those things, so that it becomes a memorable event that when you walk out of there, you're thinking, God, I got to go back to Axis Bold as Love, or I got to go get Axis Bold as Love because I saw Eric Johnson do One Rainy Wish. You know, I want to hear that. That's that, you know, I want to hear what that song was all about when Jimmy did it. So it's a cool way of celebrating the music.
Do you put guardrails on the artists? Like, I mean, you know, let's say you approach, you know, I just saw Joanne Shaw Taylor, for example. You know, she's going to be involved in that. Does she come in and say to you, hey, I'd like to do, I don't know, pick a song?
It's a discussion. No. We don't put any guardrails on them. And it's really a discussion. Like, you know, Kenny Wayne Shepherd does a really cool blend of Voodoo Child, the long blues, with Voodoo Child Slight Return. You know, Zakk Wylde does an extended version of Manic Depression. So, you know, we look at that as, you know, as a cool way of showing the influence. You know, it isn't like you got to, hey, no, you know, this song was 2 minutes long. You got to hold it this way. You got to do it this way.
Right.
I think that, you know, when you bring in like the Calvin Cook and Chuck Campbell, the Sacred Steel, you know, they're coming at it from a gospel tradition and they feel it in a certain way. So I think it only adds to it. It really does. It's kind of cool to see how it comes into these folks and then back out of them in a setting like this.
Do you, as these tours have gone on, I mean, you've had obviously the cast, for lack of a better word, changes, which adds a certain variability. But do you tend, when you're kind of curating this to look at it, it's okay, we're going to go a little bit deeper into, you know, you mentioned Axis Bold as Love or Band of Gypsies or something a little more focused on these tours, or is it really just what moves the artist the most?
I think it's the latter. It really, you know, when we last year, when, you know, it's funny, when we first met Christone Kingfish Ingram, man, Buddy Guy in 2016 said to me, and Buddy Summit I've been worked on projects with since 1983. So we have a wonderful friendship. He's great. But he just said, I want you to see this young man. And so I'm going to bring him down and he's going to sit in with us. And he did. And at that time he was 16 and he was just amazing. And so, you know, he's been a part of things that we've done since then. And on this tour we did last fall, you know, he came up to me and said, I love the song Who Knows from the Band of Gypsies. I would love to do it. And I have an arrangement that I would like, you know, and it was great. So we really do love that. I mean, I think there's to see an artist kind of share with you why they love a song and why they want to present it in the way that they love it. That's exciting. You know, that's really, really cool to be able to, you know, to be a part of that and to provide a platform for that to happen.
Yeah. You mentioned something a bit back about this not being, you know, three guys getting up dressing like the Experience, you know, putting on costumes and doing this. And as you were saying that, it kind of dawned on me, there are tribute bands to everybody, but I don't see a tremendous amount of Jimi Hendrix. Actually, I don't even know that I honestly could say I have seen a Jimi Hendrix tribute show, you know, in the sense of dressing up like Jimmy. Is that something that as kind of the gatekeepers of his music that you guys try to limit, or do you really not get a say in that? Like someone wants to do that.
If somebody wants to go ahead and do it, they just go ahead and do it. I mean, that's, you know, it's public performance rights, all those things. Yeah. I mean, they're out there. I mean, that's fine. But I'm saying it's not what we do.
Sure.
Because I think that even though our tour is called Experience Hendrix, it's really about the song. So we're looking at it as, I'm not trying to evoke an era.
Right.
Because I think in our audience, if you can believe it, you've got kind of what I'd call grads to dads.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have a tremendous amount of young folks that come out. And because they got into it from Robert Randolph or Stevie Ray Vaughan or Prince or somebody, they heard them do a cover of a Jimi Hendrix song. Mm-hmm. And for them, it's relevant. So I want to know more about this. They've heard Fish cover him. They've heard, you know, all of these diverse acts cover Jimmy, and that's led them to our show. So, you know, the Hendrix family doesn't get into that. The difficulty about putting on a Jimi Hendrix tribute show is the virtuosity.
Yeah.
You've got to have that skill. It's a pretty damn unique skill that Jimi Hendrix had, you know, to be able to not only to play in the manner in which he did, but to be a dynamic stage performer.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that that's what maybe holds it back from, you know, things like Beatlemania or some of the Led Zeppelin ones you've seen. You know, I just think people love those songs, and that's why those shows. I mean, if you think about Australian Pink Floyd, for goodness sake, I mean, you know, the band's not going to tour. They're never going to get back together again. So for some people, they just want to be in a venue celebrating this music that they dig.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the product that you're putting on here, I think does it in such an interesting way, because you're taking, you know, you could hear the same song that, I mean, sometimes when you go to see a tribute act, you think to yourself, okay, I could hear the song on the radio done exactly the way they're doing it. You know, but you're not going to get Devin Allman's version of a song, you know, for the 400th time. So I think it's a really a neat way to put a different spin on it. I know listening to the Stone Free album, you know, when it came out, I remember, you know, when that came out and the first thing you hear is The Cure, you know, that's just not something you're going to hear.
But it's great that you raised that point, because that's exactly why it was the first song on the record. You know, when Jeff Gold at Warner Records told me that, you know, Robert Smith is a huge fan, they have a great idea for this. Mm-hmm. And so we were super excited about it. It's that same mindset that we take to the tour. If Robert Smith were to come to us and say, I want to be a part of this, we love it. I mean, I think that, you know, to me, you know, we've had, you know, I love the idea of putting things together that you can't normally see. So we had Joe Satriani in Living Color as his backing band.
Yeah.
Same thing we did with Steve Vai. You know, it pushes these artists into areas they don't normally do, but because the respect among the players is such that they're excited about the prospect, like, oh, this is great. I mean, Joe did an amazing thing with Kenny Aronoff and Doug Pinnick from King's X as a trio, you know? So that kind of thing, I think, you can go see Joe all the time and he's fantastic, but to see him in our show doing that like that, that's a one-off experience, you know? And I think that to pardon the pun, but that's really what we're looking to do, is create a fun night that you come away with thinking, damn, that was really exciting.
Yeah. I think that's part of what I think so exciting about this is because you're seeing people, you know, in elements that you don't normally see, you know,
correct.
And it's music obviously that, you know, you're, I think anybody listening to the show is going to be a fan of some of those songs of Jimmy's at a minimum. So you're seeing, you know, I don't see a tour coming through that you guys have put on where you say, boy, there's really nobody there I want to see, or, Boy, this would be a cool way to, you know, maybe someone isn't exposed to Joanne Shaw Taylor. There's a good chance to see what she can do without, you know, plunking down 50, $60 to go see her headline show when you're not that familiar with her music. So it's a really cool thing to do. When you put a tour together, though, look, you circle this tour. How far in advance do you start trying to
Well,
line up schedules? Because to me, that
it's a
sounds like the
year.
headache.
It's a year. Because what we do is I look and I go to our, I've got a lot of friends over the years that we've developed, and I say, okay, when would you be available? And then we whittle it down, and it starts to winnow down to that time where you can get the most artists during that window. So in the fall, when we did the West Coast, it was mid-September to mid-October. This year, it's mid-March through mid-April. And I think as a result of the change post-COVID, and certainly in the change in the music industry, where it's difficult for artists to make any money off of the streaming sites, playing live is really important. So, finding a time to get them to be able to take themselves out of their own career pursuits and to do something fun like this, we're lucky in that we have a long, long history. People, people are always asking us to be a part of it. So it isn't if we have to get on bended knee, but it's just something that you've got to logistically really route in a way that doesn't impact the artists that want to participate. We've had a, we have a situation on this tour where, a couple of the artists have to pop off, do some shows, and then come back. But that's the nature of the game. We just fill their spot while they're away and then, build it back up once they're there.
Yeah, I imagine this isn't a hard sell to an artist as far as just people who enjoy being around the type of people. I can't imagine what probably the more fun has to be backstage, you know, in the
Is.
practice rooms and the sound checks. You know, I'm sure there's just magic you see constantly there. But I'm looking at this and thinking, you know, there are certain artists you'd have to start on 2028's tour now to try to get a window. You know, so many people, you know, especially with the fact that everybody has to tour to make a living,
That's
there's
right.
not a lot of downtime for a lot of guys. You know,
That's right.
the December is pretty much the only time that some artists are not available. So, well, John, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule. I know you've probably got a million logistical things to get to. We will see you on March 13th when you get here to Western Pennsylvania. You'll be playing the Palace in Greensburg. Tickets still available. Wouldn't sleep on getting those tickets if you want to see the show. It should be an amazing night. I want to thank you so much for your time, man.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Manic depression is searching my soul. I know what I want, but I just don't know how to go about getting it. Feeling, sweet feeling, drops from my fingers, Manic depression is a captured my soul.
All right, a very big thank you to John McDermott for taking the time to do the interview. Again, Thursday, March 13th, 8 o'clock, Palace Theater, Greensburg, Pennsylvania. The likes of Kenny Wayne Shepherd, Kingfish Ingram, Eric Johnson, Dweezil Zappa, Devin Allman, Chris Layton, and that is literally about half of the list. Joanne Shaw Taylor, a recent addition to that lineup. So, an amazing show, a great chance to get out and see. You know, if you have trouble getting out to a lot of shows, this is a way to see a lot of really cool artists in a very, very short window. And if you're a fan of Hendrix music, and how could you not be? What a cool way to see some of these artists instead of doing the, you know, album tour greatest hits sort of thing. This is a chance to see your favorite artist doing something completely different, completely off the cuff. There's obviously not backing tracks or anything like that. This is as real as it gets. So, an awesome night of music ahead. Tickets are available at westmorelandculturaltrust.org, or if you head over to ironcityrocks.com and go to the episode notes, we'll have a link for you to get your tickets. There's still plenty of seats available for that. Come out for an amazing night of music. You can visit us, ironcityrocks.com. We are on all the social medias as Iron City Rocks, and you can drop us an email at ironcityrocks@gmail.com if you have some thoughts on the show, things you'd like to hear about, things you'd like to hear less about, styles of music you're interested in, etc. So drop us a note. Love to hear from you. Always be on the lookout for giveaways, contests, concert announcements, and such. So we appreciate the follow on any of the social medias. And until next time, thank you for listening.